morning. It's good to be with you today. Glad to have those that are visiting with us. We started last week a series on the subject of idolatry. And last week we noted three definitions to help us expose idolatry in our lives. First of all, idolatry is what we spend most of our passions and energy and emotion and financial resources toward. Also, idolatry is taking the good things that are given to us by God and making them the ultimate thing, thinking that those things can give us significance, security and safety and fulfillment. And certainly, when you look at the Old Testament and the warnings against idolatry, idols serve none of those purposes and can provide none of those things. Idolatry can be defined as something that captures our heart and captures our passions, and something that we may think that we can't live without. And in today's lesson, we want to talk about the idol of greed. And the scriptures explicitly identify greed or covetousness as one of the idols of our world. In Colossians chapter 3, verse 5, Paul says, "Therefore put to death whatever in you is worldly, sexual immorality, impurity, lust, evil desire, and greed," which is idolatry. Some translations say covetousness. So this problem of greed is certainly, not something that's new, and it certainly is growing. We can see that in a prosperous nation that we live in. And I can remember when I was growing up, and if I was sick and had to stay home from school and watch TV, didn't have all the choices that you have today when you watch TV. You had three channels, maybe four. If you had VHF in your area, or at UHF, you may have had more channels, but generally three different ones. And if those of you that are as old as me remember, what choices we had in the morning. We didn't have a bunch of women on there on a talk show talking, and we didn't have doctors with a talk show. It was game shows. And you had 3 hours of nothing but game shows. And, I didn't really mind that, and I still like to watch game shows from time to time, but you think about The Price is Right, and that show is still on today. And every show went about the same way. Let's see what Joanne is playing for. It's a brand new refrigerator. And you know what every person does? They jump up and down and they scream like the refrigerator is the greatest thing in the world, and poor Bob Barker gets tackled. And so, they start screaming and run around. And of course, that's what they like to have on the show, is somebody that would be enthusiastic. Now you think about that for a moment. This free refrigerator, which really doesn't turn out to be free, because if you win it, you have to pay the taxes on it. But it causes this emotional reaction every time. Now people don't get that happy when they see their families. They get this free thing, and people certainly are not that joyful when they worship God. But you give somebody something for free, and they just go bananas. You go to a football game. Sometimes we go to Auburn games. They have those T-shirt cannons. And people go bananas when they shoot T-shirts into the stands. And what do you end up getting if you catch one? You get a shirt that doesn't fit. It is not going to be your size. And so, but, people will go bananas for a white shirt with a Chick-fil-A logo on it that's been shot out of a cannon. And this morning, Brendan read for us in 2 Kings chapter 5, and we see a servant of God who had a problem with the idol of greed. In 2 Kings chapter 5, verses 15 through 27. Last week, we saw that Naaman was a man who had been very successful in the things that he did and in his professional life. And at the end of that account, we see that he finally does humble himself, and he goes and he does what the prophet Elisha tells him to do, to go wash in the Jordan, and that his, seven times in the Jordan actually, and he has that serious skin disease of leprosy cured. And in verse 15 of 2 Kings chapter 5, he returns to Elisha and attempts to give him gifts. It says that he returned to the man of God, he and all his company, and he came and stood before him, and he said, "Behold, I know that there is no God in all the earth but in Israel, so now accept a present from your servant." And so, as Brennan read, and you heard that, he attempted to give him these gifts because he had been healed. He was thankful for that, and he certainly was a man of means and was able to offer Elisha those gifts, and Elisha refuses those payments. And Naaman encourages and urges him to take the gifts, but Elisha takes an oath before the Lord he will not take any gift. As you read on there, verse 16, "But he said, 'As the Lord lives before whom I stand, I will receive none.' And he urged him to take it, but he refused. Then Naaman said, 'If not, please let there be given to your servant 2 mule loads of earth. For from now on your servant will not offer burnt offering or sacrifice to any god but to the Lord. In this manner the Lord may pardon your servant when my master goes into the house of Rimmon to worship there, leaning on my arm, and I bow myself in the house of Rimmon. When I bow myself in the house of Rimmon, the Lord pardon your servant in this manner.' He said, 'Go in peace.'" But what we see here is that Elisha is probably reacting in such a way that many of us would not react when we are receiving a gift or somebody tries to offer us something. When I was in college and worked at Disney World, I drove the buses around Epcot that they used to have their Around the World Showcase. And at night when people were coming out of the restaurants after enjoying a good meal, they wouldn't want to walk all the way back up to the entrance. And so we would give them, we were supposed to get people out of the park, you know. And so these were people that were in the park after closing. And so it wasn't just about us being friendly. We were trying to clear the park. So we would give them a ride, and they would try to tip us many times. We were not allowed to take tips. And what Disney told us is that we needed to refuse the tips 3 times. And if they kept insisting after three times, then we could accept the tip. And so the joke among us is when somebody offered us a tip, we went, "Oh, no, no, no." And so that was the 3 times. And so, you know, we're kind of like, not like Elisha, you know. Elisha is refusing this. He's refusing this gift. He's refusing this payment because he has provided something of value, certainly a lot more value than somebody giving you a ride on a bus, but a value that he has been cured of a disease. And so this, you know, Naaman sees that he has been given of something of great value, but Elisha, that didn't come from him. You know, that came from God, and he's not going to accept that gift because he made an oath before the Lord that he was not going to do that. But what we want to look at here is the heart of Elisha's servant Gehazi. In verse 20 of 2 Kings 5, it says, "Gehazi, the servant of Elisha, the man of God, said, 'See, my master has spared this Naaman, the Syrian, in not accepting from his hand what he brought. As the Lord lives, I will run after him and get something from him.'" So Gehazi recognizes what Naaman does, is that he was provided something of value, and he says, "Elisha didn't accept a gift, and Naaman received something of value, so I'm going to go, and I'm going to go and get something from him." So you see his thinking. Elisha doesn't want this money, but I do. And how could Elisha not take this money from the Syrian? So his heart is a heart of greed that leads him to go to Naaman. And what does he tell Naaman? He said, "Well, you know, I really felt like Elisha should have taken the money, and I was hoping that you would give me something." No, he comes up with a story. It says, "When Naaman had gone from him a short distance," verse 20 says, "Gehazi, the servant of Elisha, said, 'See, my master has spared this Naaman, the Syrian, and not accepting from his hand what he brought. As the Lord lives, I will run after him and get something from him.' So Gehazi followed Naaman. And when Naaman saw someone running after him, he got down from the chariot to meet him and said, 'Is all well?' And he said, 'All is well. My master has sent me to say, there have just now come to me from the hill country of Ephraim 2 young men of the sons of the prophets. Please give them a talent of silver and 2 changes of clothing.' And Naaman said, be pleased to accept 2 talents. And he urged him and tied up 2 talents of silver in 2 bags with 2 changes of clothing and laid them on 2 of his servants. And they carried them before Gehazi. And when he came to the hill, he took them from their hand and put them in the house and sent the men away, and they departed. And so Gehazi takes the wealth from the servants after lying about some sons of prophets who traveled a great distance. So basically he's saying, you know, we had some unexpected company come, and we need to take care of them. And so he lies about that. But verse 25 is very interesting, because it says, he went in and stood before his master, and Elisha said, where have you been, Gehazi? And he said, your servant went nowhere. And it kind of reminds you of the child that has chocolate all over their face, and you ask them, have you been eating the cookies? No, I haven't been. Why would you think such a thing? Because obviously, you know, Elisha knows that he has gone and done this thing. He said, where have you been? Oh, nowhere. And so what you see repeatedly throughout this chapter is a description that is given to Elisha. And that is the man of God. Sometimes Elisha is not even identified by name. He's just identified as the man of God. And, you know, we're not even told until later in the chapter who the man of God is. But, you know, Gehazi is the one who thinks that he can get away with this by lying to the man of God. You know, he has this idol of greed in his life. And Elisha reveals exactly what he knows. I know what you have done. Verse 26, he said to him, did not my heart go when the man turned from his chariot to meet you? Was it at a time to accept money and garments, olive orchards and vineyards, sheep and oxen, male servants and female servants? So that's a very telling statement there, that Elisha, without the aid of any of the things that we know today, it's not like he tracked him, you know, with his iPhone or something about, you know, where he was. I saw exactly where you went. You know, kids today, they can be tracked by their parents. The parents know where it is that they are, even if the child doesn't tell them. But this day, this is not happening. But Elisha knows, because God told him that what has happened here. So Elisha's heart was with him. He knows what took place. And the leprosy that Naaman had been healed of is now going to affect Gehazi. So I want you to see something about Gehazi and Naaman. Who is it that has the generous heart? Who is the one that is not greedy? Who is the one that is not covetous? Naaman, who, when we begin the story, he is the pagan Syrian who has come to and learned about the true and living God. You know, by the end of the account, he's praising God. And he is the one that is expressing great generosity. But Gehazi, who is the servant of the man of God, so you could say he's a servant of God, is full of greed in his heart. He is the one, probably outwardly, would be seen to be more holy and righteous than Naaman would have been, but his heart is corrupted by materialism. And so certainly there is a point for us that we need to examine ourselves. You know, we can claim to love God, and we can claim to love Christ, and we can expound upon that and express that to others. But sometimes Christ is not the only thing that matters to people. We want to acquire things. We want to accumulate things. We see our wealth as our wealth. We see our possessions as our possessions from our hard work. And our hearts can be easily distracted by wealth. And sometimes people have a lack of service in their service to God or their devotion to God because, well, I've got to make money. And God warned his people not to let their hearts turn from God. If you recall in Deuteronomy chapter 8, verse 11, I know that's a little small on the screen. I was going to split that up on several slides and forgot to do it. But if you can see that, it says, "Take care lest you forget the Lord your God by not keeping his commandments and his rules and his statutes, which I command you today, lest when you have eaten and are full and have built good houses and live in them, and when your herds and flocks multiply and your silver and gold is multiplied and all that you have is multiplied, then your heart be lifted up and you forget the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery, who led you through the great and terrifying wilderness with its fiery serpents, scorpions, and thirsty ground where there was no water, who brought you water out of the flinty rock, who led you in the wilderness with manna that your fathers did not know, that he might humble and test you to do good in the end. Beware lest you say in your heart, 'My power and the might of my hand have gotten me this wealth.' You shall remember the Lord your God, for it is he who gives you power to get wealth, that he may confirm his covenant that he swore to your fathers as it is this day. And if you forget the Lord your God and go after other gods and serve them and worship them, I solemnly warn you today that you will surely perish. Like the nations that the Lord makes to perish before you, so shall you perish because you would not obey the voice of the Lord your God." So this is a very familiar warning, and we've read this at various times in the past. Because what we see here is that every one of these warnings that the Lord gives are ones that are ignored by the Israelites. They are traps that the Israelites constantly fell into. They fell into idolatry. They, you know, got complacent and thought that they did all these things themselves because they had success. And God tries to warn them about that. This is what is going to happen if you forget whose things these are and how you received these things. So it really defines the problem of wealth and greed and covetousness that many people have. You know, God gives this direct warning. You're going to have things. You're going to have food. You're going to have good houses. And your wealth is going to be multiplied. And you know what's going to happen? You're going to forget God. You're going to forget everything that he's done for you. And you're going to say in your heart that you are God because you did it by your own hand. Money and possessions tend to steal affections away from the Lord. And now, many times people don't want to believe that. And they keep running into this same wall thinking that, you know, that I can love money and still love Jesus. But let's look at a few other scriptures. And certainly there's a lot of them that have things to say about the problem with wealth. Mark chapter 10, verse 25. "It is easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich person to enter the kingdom of God." Jesus warning his disciples about those that are rich have a hard time putting their trust in God because their trust is in themselves. Luke chapter 16. "No man can serve two masters, for he will either hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon, or God and money." In Luke chapter 6, verse 24, "But woe to you who are rich, for you have received your consolation." Also in Luke chapter 8, just a couple of chapters over, "And for what fell among the thorns, those are those who hear, but as they go on their way, they are choked by the cares and riches and pleasures of life, and their fruit does not mature." 1 Timothy chapter 6, Paul warns Timothy about those who are rich. He says, "Those who desire to be rich fall into temptation and into a snare, into many senseless and harmful desires that plunge people into ruin and destruction." He also tells Timothy in verse 10, "For the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. It is through this craving that some have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves through with many pangs." in 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 17. He says, "The rich in this present age, charge them not to be haughty, nor to set their hopes on the uncertainty of riches, but on God, who richly provides us with everything to enjoy. They are to do good, to be rich in good works, to be generous and ready to share, thus storing up treasure for themselves as a good foundation for the future, that it may take hold of that which is truly life." Hebrews 13, verse 5, "Keep your life free from the love of money and be content with what you have, for he has said, I will never leave you nor forsake you." So you notice the common theme in all of these passages. It doesn't say it's impossible for the rich to serve God. It doesn't say that the rich are automatically going to be disqualified from a life of service to God and are never going to be able to go to heaven. But it serves as a warning. What it is it's a continual warning that you see that you can't put your trust in riches. And those that are rich are really going to have to beware of this tendency to put your trust in the things of this world instead of your trust in the things of God. You notice a common thread or common theme as you see the rich of this world. As a general rule, those that are rich and have the things of the world don't put a lot of trust in God. Most religious bodies of all types are not generally filled with all the rich of the world. They're usually filled with those that are more of modest means, who may have an easier time putting their trust in God. Not saying that the rich can't put their trust in God, but you see that trend. You see that warning here. You have to keep your life free from money. So God is warning us, and we need to accept that warning. And if our heart is a heart that's greedy and covetous and seeking money, and that's our primary goal in our life, it's going to be very hard for us to inherit the kingdom of God. So how do we keep our lives free from that? First of all, we have to realize that contentment is something that is learned. Paul said in Philippians chapter 4 that I'm not speaking of being in need, but I have learned in whatever situation I am to be content. And, you know, I don't know what Paul's problem was with contentment in the past, but he's saying that he's evolved. That he has learned to be content. And to me, that means he realizes that he's made some progress. That there were other times in which it was harder for him to be content. And certainly, when you look at the things that he suffered and the life that he's now living as he writes from prison is a lot different than the life that he had before he started serving God. So he did have some adjusting to do. But he says, I'm not asking for anything. I'm not talking about what it is that I need, but I've learned to be content. I think that's interesting because I think contentment is not something that you're accidentally going to stumble upon, that you're going to learn to be content accidentally. Oh, I woke up one day and I'm content and I don't care about material things anymore. You know, you're not going to wake up and suddenly, you know, that happens. To break the stranglehold that materialism has on our lives, we have to make a conscious effort and a concerted effort to fight, you know, from our hearts from straying away from what our focus should be, and that would be, you know, Paul preached Christ crucified, and that was to him the greatest goal that he had in his life. He was forsaking everything else in his life to concentrate on Christ. And contentment, you know, it's not going to happen as long as we keep looking at, you know, what can I get, what can I acquire, what can I pursue, because it rips our hearts away from where they need to be. Also, we need to see the fruitlessness of greed. Ecclesiastes chapter 5 and verse 10. Ecclesiastes chapter 5 and verse 10, the wise writer says, "The one who loves money will never be satisfied with money. He who loves wealth will never be satisfied with his income. This also is futile. I can remember years ago listening to preachers that would read this verse, and they would talk about how loving money you could never be satisfied with it. They would reference the Lay's potato chip commercial that a lot of you that are older remember, and that you know what the slogan was, is that you can't eat just one. And that's what, you know, all the ads in the past are much better than the ones that we have now. But you'd open up the potato chip bag and somebody would eat one, and there was, it's just a running gag in a series of ads that, you know, you can't just open a bag and eat one Lay's potato chip. You just have to keep going and going until you finish the bag. And that's what the wise writer is saying here about wealth. That the desire to acquire things, when are you going to be satisfied with what you have? You know, he who loves wealth will never be satisfied. Seeking wealth is not going to make you happy. I know we all think we'd be happier with more. And I've heard it said many times that money can't buy happiness, but somebody will always pipe up and say, well, I would really like to try and see if that's true. Just to see if it could buy happiness. But, you know, we have to trust the scriptures that tell us what's important. And the scriptures tell us that we need to break the stranglehold that this idol has. And going back to what Colossians said, that greed and covetousness is idolatry. First of all, if we see the generosity that Christ has toward us, that will help us, because it will help keep our hearts from going astray, because we realize what the greatest riches and possessions are. And if we could all just for a moment have a glimpse of heaven, if we could all just be transported there for a few minutes and see what it's like, I think that would change a lot of people's hearts, wouldn't it? But do we really need that? Do we really need, we can trust what God said about heaven and what a wonderful place that it is, and that it's something that we should look forward to, and it should be the focus of our life of trying to get there. But we let the things that are right in front of our nose distract us from the greatest goal that we can have. God said in Deuteronomy that we just read that He gave them the prosperity that they had. What that means is that the things that they had were not really their own. They were borrowed. They were generously given by God. James said God is the giver of every good and perfect gift. We have to stop and say, wait a minute, the things that I have are not really mine. Everything that I have belongs to God and is to be used for God. So we need to change our perspective so that we see what we have is not our own, but it's God's blessing to us. And we need to understand that God's great generosity toward us is found in the gospel. Paul said in 2 Corinthians chapter 8, verses 8 and 9, that I say this not as a command, but to prove by the earnestness of others that your love is genuine. For you know the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, that though he was rich, yet for your sakes he became poor, so that you by your poverty might become rich. Jesus was certainly rich because of what he left behind to come and be on this earth for us. He became poor so that we would be spiritually rich, and spiritually rich for eternity. And so if that's the focus of our life, and we remember that, then the love of the things of this world should really take second place. The unsearchable riches of Christ has made it so that we don't really need anything else. And Jesus' love and salvation have given us a status that, you know, physical wealth can't really match. money can't give us the control that we need. The ultimate control that we need is of ourselves, is of our eternity. And when we deepen that understanding, we won't have a problem with the idolatry of greed. I believe what Paul is saying is that Christ really needs to be enough for you. Christ needs to be it. Christ needs to be enough. And if Christ is not enough for you, then really you're never going to have enough, because you're going to be seeking after something else. So I hope this will be useful to you and help you be focused on things that are truly valuable, that we won't get caught up in the idolatry of greed, and that we can encourage ourselves and encourage others to follow after what truly matters in this life. If we can help you in any way, respond to the invitation. We invite you to come while we stand together and sing.
Who will follow Jesus standing for the ride, holding up the banner in the thickest fight, listening for his